Recovery Today on UKHealthRadio.com. Join me and my guests on this voyage of recovery and discovery. Hello, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Jim Smith, and I'm presenting my show Recovery Today. Now, this is quite special because it's my penultimate show. It's number 23, but it's my last solo guest show. I'm doing my last show tomorrow. Actually, I'm going down to a rehab to do that. But my guest today is a lovely musician, a lovely friend called Jennifer Maidman. And, you know, initially when I devised this show, you know, I wanted to interview people that had big changes in their lives. And most of my guests have been recovering from addiction, alcoholism, and, you know, there's a couple that have had other issues, but we're not going to focus on that today with Jennifer. Jennifer's going to talk about a huge change in her life that's come to be. So without more to do, I'm just going to introduce Jennifer and ask you, Jen, you know, where you were born and say a little bit about your early life and your family.
Okay. Hi, Jim. It's a real pleasure to do this. So I was born in 1958 in Upminster in Essex.
Yeah.
So I'm an Essex girl.
Essex girl.
But I was an Essex boy when I was born.
Yes. Yes.
So I was born, I was christened Ian Maidman.
Hmm.
And I grew up in Essex and East London. We moved into East London when I was three.
Yeah.
So I was growing up really through the 60s, which was an interesting time to be a kid.
Yeah, yeah.
Very interesting time. And, my family was, both my folks have passed now. They've gone. But, you know, mum and dad were lovely people. You know, our family had its issues, like any family. But, you know, I had quite a bit of security and love, I think, when I was growing up.
Yeah.
So I was always grateful for that. But, you know, there was stuff going on inside me that was difficult. And probably very difficult, not just for me to understand, but also for my family to understand. Because I think in those days there was no template for this be transgender as now.
There wasn't. No.
It all didn't exist, really.
That's right. No, very much so. Yeah. And things, obviously, I was born in 48, a decade before you, but things in 58 were more rigid. There were more rigid social structures and more gender ideas about what was for a boy, what was for a girl. It was all very rigid.
Very much so. Those are my early memories. Was just sort of, the stereotype for transgender people is that, you know, we're attracted to the wrong toys. And I mean, I don't think I was particularly girly because it wasn't really just about. I think it's more about what's on the inside.
Yeah,
but I can remember that thing being warned off things.
Mm.
You know, I remember sort of being in what do they call this? A kindergarten. And I was interested in a pram, you know. And actually, I was more interested in it because it had wheels, probably.
Yeah. Because
but I remember just sort of going the woman that was running the creche saying, "Oh no, you know, you can't play with that. That's for the girls."
For the girls,
and I was sort of, "Well, why? You know, it looks like fun to just kind of push this thing around the room, you know." And also I wanted. You know, boys weren't supposed to play with dolls.
No.
And then Action Man came along.
Yeah.
Yes. But then I wasn't allowed to have an Action Man because it was violent. So I couldn't win. You know.
You probably answered it in a way anyway, but slightly. But I was going to ask you, what your earliest memories of feeling, not just not comfortable in your skin, but feeling... Yeah, about your gender, you know, how the earliest memories you have about that.
Yeah.
Being aware of all that.
It's quite vague. I think the memories are to do with as much to do with sort of looking outside myself at the world, and gravitating towards girls, and thinking initially just sort of, you know, in a way not knowing that that was anything wrong with that, and just wanting to sort of hang around with girls at school. Other kids, I remember boys saying to me, I remember one boy saying to me one day, he said, "You're like a girl." I was about five.
All right. Yeah.
And I was a bit baffled because I hadn't really thought it through.
No. What springs to mind, I'm just thinking the word tomboy. Do you remember that saying?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, it opens up a whole new way of looking at it. But I remember girls, you know, when I was growing up, that kind of did things that were supposedly meant for boys.
Yes.
Were called tomboys.
And that was sort of okay, actually.
That was okay. Yeah. Said, she climbs trees and she, you know, gets a bit rough, but that's all right because she's a tomboy.
Yeah. I think probably because it might be that thing of, you know, because male things tended to be looked at as more important, superior.
Yes, they did. You know,
for a girl to aspire to that was that's a good thing.
It's a good thing.
But if you were a boy and you were sort of aspiring to something that was supposedly feminine,
My
granddad, who was, you know, I mean, not by any means a nasty man, but you know, he would really sort of, you know, or your puff or something. That was the way people thought.
Yes.
So then I think fairly quickly you start to, or I did, you know, start to question what's natural, because you're not really able to just gravitate naturally towards whatever. So I had that sense of like, there's at least bits of me and maybe a lot of me that seems to fall outside these parameters that exist in the world. Yeah. You know? And I'm not sure what that is. That was the early thing.
Mm. Did you receive any discrimination and taunting, bullying?
I was quite badly bullied. Yeah.
Was that your secondary school or primary?
Well, I went to primary school I think less than a year, and then which was a mixed school.
Yeah.
And I was sort of doing all right there, and I was hanging around with the girls. You know, just was.
Yeah.
Yeah, reasonably happy with that. And then myself and my older brother, we both were, our parents moved us. I think they just thought we'd do better to a private school.
Oh, I see, yes.
It was a very small private school in Ilford.
Mm.
And I guess I was six.
Mm.
And that was a boys-only school. And that's really when I started to get sort of bullied.
Yes, yeah.
And the first time I was really strongly aware of it was the school play at Christmas. Really? We had a nativity play.
Oh, nativity, yeah.
And
yeah.
So somebody had to play Mary.
Yes.
And I got the part, and the teacher announced that, you know, Maidman 2, as I was called, because there was two.
Oh, your brother, yes.
Maidman 2 will be playing Mary. And I was, like, delighted.
Oh, of course.
And then there was this kind of hoots of derision.
Yeah.
And sort of, you know. I was like, oh, no, this is, I'm not supposed to feel good about this.
No.
And I did feel good about it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think little by little, you gradually, it's like a lot of these things become quite shame-based, don't they?
They do, yeah.
And so I built up this core of shame about, something wrong with my identity. I don't really know what it is. That was something to do with gender or sex.
Yes, yeah.
I became very ashamed and quite isolated, I think, as a kid. Yeah,
yeah.
Very isolated, actually. Yeah.
And when did you discover music? Because I would imagine that when you did, it was an immense outlet for you.
It was huge.
And a wonderful world to be part of.
Well, it was always there. My dad was my dad was a sort of keen amateur, so the house was full of instruments.
We had a piano,
banjo, an accordion, a violin, a mandolin, which I broke. Sorry, Dad. It was an accident. So it was always around. I would sort of noodle and tinkle a bit, and my dad would show me things.
Yeah.
So I was pretty young, and I think I very quickly latched onto it as something that was beyond all this.
Yes.
Beyond all this conflict.
That's right.
Was this thing called music. And yeah. The more I heard.
Yeah.
You know, it was by then we were into sort of just getting to the mid-60s.
Yes.
The Beatles. Yeah. The Beach Boys.
Of course, yeah.
You know, and hearing this wonderful music, I can, the vivid memories of hearing the Beach Boys on the wireless. We had a big old valve wireless.
That's right.
And seeing my dad.
Yes.
Because I remember hearing, I think it was, might have been Good Vibrations.
Oh, yeah. Great track, yeah.
Or even, no, it was earlier than that. Maybe Barbara Ann.
Barbara Ann.
Yeah, I was thinking probably 64, 65.
And I Get Around, Barbara Ann.
And hearing that, I'm just going, oh, this is great. And then my dad picking out, because he had a good ear.
Yeah.
Picking it out on the piano. And it was like magic.
Wow.
It was like, wow.
Yes.
I want to do that.
Yes.
You know.
So how long was it before you did do that? Where you picked, you chose an instrument. How long?
I saved up and I bought my first, so all my pocket money, you know, just like a shilling or something.
Yeah.
Like that. And I saved up, I think it was 6 guineas.
Yeah, guineas. I love guineas.
For the young people.
That's it.
That was a pound and a shilling.
And a shilling. Yeah. One guinea, a pound, and a shilling.
6 guineas. And it was this East European guitar.
Oh, yeah.
From a catalogue.
Yes.
The Bell catalogue.
I remember the Bell catalogue. Yeah. Wow, Surbiton.
The cheapest guitar.
Bell at Surbiton.
There you go.
Wow, I had the same catalogue, listeners. With a, there we
really hard to play.
Oh, yeah.
It was a guitar.
Yeah, they were, those cheap instruments.
It was a guitar.
Yeah.
And then I quickly discovered that my chemistry teacher, a guy called David Newman, was a pretty good guitar player.
Really?
Yeah. And he sort of offered to give lessons after school.
Oh, yeah.
For, I think, again, a shilling or something.
Yeah.
I said, Mum! You know. So, and that's it. I was away.
Wow.
And I never looked back, really.
No. Well, look, this draws us really into a good time to play your first choice. This is by the Kinks.
Oh, yeah.
And it is a memorable song called Lola, isn't
Lola,
it?
Lola, yeah.
We'll say a bit about it before we play it.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think this was late 60s or maybe 1970s.
Yeah.
It was... I remember hearing it on the radio, and it's got these lines in it, like, boys will be girls and girls will be boys. It's a mixed up world.
Crazy world.
Yeah, and it was the first song.
That's
I don't know whether it was the first song that anyone had written, but the first song I'd heard on the BBC, I think it was still the Home Service then, that seemed to have, somebody was saying something about something that I felt.
Yes.
And I didn't even know what, because it's quite ambiguous, the song, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
I thought, maybe there's something out there.
Yeah.
Wow. Maybe there's some people like me.
Mm.
And this might be what this song is about. So, you know, that's, yeah.
Okay, Jen, let's play it.
Yeah, let's play it.
The Kinks with Lola.
It's like Coca-Cola, C-O-L-A, Cola. She walked up to me and she asked me to dance. I asked her her name and in a dark brown voice she said hello. I'm
Well, that was Lola by the Kinks, and a great track and a great sound, but to you, Jen, much more.
Yeah. Yeah, really.
Kind I mean, of unlocked like I said, it was unlocked that first, a door. Almost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a lot that came, there was a lot of androgyny, I think, that came in the 70s.
Yes.
Bowie. You know, there was a sense in me of like, well, where do I... do I fit into this somewhere?
Yeah.
You know, but I did feel like I was more Lola than Ziggy Stardust.
Yes.
Although I loved it.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's something about Bowie that was like, he was always male.
He was, you're right.
You
he
know.
Was, although, yeah, he was.
And likewise, a lot of those sort of glam pop stars.
Yeah.
You could always sort of see the beard under the makeup.
That's very true. Yeah. You could. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and that's part of the appeal as well.
So when did you kind of get into the music business? When was that? In your late teens or?
Mid-teens, really. Yeah. I mean, I was at school. I changed school again.
Yeah.
I did my O-levels, as they were in those exams.
Yeah.
At 14, which was 2 years early.
Yeah, that is early.
And then I was sort of just twiddling my thumbs. And the school was trying to sort of push me into academic pursuits.
Yeah.
Maths, which I really, just didn't like it.
No.
And so, to cut a long story short, I moved schools again to a very liberal, mixed, I don't know, it was comprehensive grammar school of some kind. Wanstead school. Anyway, Wanstead, it was very liberal. I had a great kind of music and art department. And I started doing music, art and drama.
Wow.
And it was like, you know, after these years of sort of being bullied and, and very academic. And it's like, wow, you know.
You've come home.
And there I was with my guitar.
Yes.
Yeah. And I met other people. And so I'm playing bands, you know.
Wow.
With some people who I to this day play with, you know. I met a guy called Adrian Lee who went on to Mike and the Mechanics.
Yes.
Amongst other things.
That's right.
Great guitarist.
Great guitarist. Player. Yeah, yeah. And yeah,
Pete Ware, he's a producer now.
Yeah.
Steve Fletcher, who I played with in Penguin Cafe Orchestra, and with Paul Brady, and I mean, lots of people that came from that school, and so by the time I was 16, we were putting on gigs at the school. We had a band called Phoebus, Phoebus rock band.
Wow.
And we did Joseph and the Amazing Technical
Dream.
So I was playing, and then we were pretty good. I had a band with it was Adrian, Steve, who was the drummer in that band? Ross Pearlstone for a while, then another guy called James Burton. And we sort of got noticed. We just started doing a few gigs. You could get gigs in those days.
Yes, yeah.
And we hooked up with Jimmy Winston, who had been... he was a keyboard player in the Small Faces.
Yeah,
He lived at the top of my road.
Did he?
And he said, I'll get you some gigs. And next thing we were playing the Marquee.
Wow.
And sort of hanging out with Stevie Marriott and all those people. Yeah. They're all East London.
That's right,
And so I just pretty much walked out of school to my parents.
Yeah.
Horror. Going, but you'll have nothing to fall back on.
That's it, fall back on.
Yeah, I'm doing gigs, it's great. You know, so 16 years old, I was playing the Speakeasy and the Marquee and all these places.
Were you playing a six string or guitar, or had you gone over to bass?
Because I have to thank Adrian for that, actually. Yeah. Because Adrian was, there's no doubt he was a better guitar player than I was. Mm. And he sort of pretty much said, look, you know, if you play bass, we can have a super group. And the other people that were a big help at that point were the Gurvitz brothers, Adrian and Paul.
Oh, yes.
Who also lived just up the road in Gadshill. So I bought a Fender bass off Paul Gurvitz. Yeah. She had sort of refinished for me. 65 quid. Thanks, Paul.
Wow.
And away we went, you know, with Jimmy as our manager. And, I mean, this could be a very long segment, so I won't say too much. But
no.
Again, cut a long story short, Laurie O'Leary, who was the manager of the Speakeasy, and was a rock manager, he was managing Humble Pie at the time. He took us on, and he got us a deal with Philips, and I think I was 17 years old. And we had a deal for a year with Philips. We made a record. With Mutt Lange, who went on to become a very, very successful producer.
Yes, yeah.
But he was not that well known at that point. We made a single. We were signed to Philips for a year, and then we were dropped because it was the punk thing was coming in.
Yeah, yeah.
It was 76, 77, and suddenly Philips said, well, we want punk bands. Mm. And we were quite musical.
Yeah. I know.
I mean, so, I love punk, but it wasn't our thing.
No. So all this was going on. Mm. And what about the inner issues, you know?
I was struggling,
You must have. Yeah.
I mean, I think I put it on the back burner. And I thought, I don't really know what this is. Mm. I think puberty for trans people, or trans people like me, it's a really difficult time because the body, the body in a way just sort of goes on its own journey.
It does, yeah.
And I did have that feeling of increasingly. When you're 16, you're sort of quite androgynous anyway.
Of course, yeah.
But then, you know, you start to get hair in all the wrong places.
That's right.
And I was just very confused.
Yes.
You know, I had girlfriends, you know, lovely girlfriends.
Yeah,
and, you know, in some ways my life was really, was going better than I expected.
Mm. Yeah.
But I was sort of haunted by this feeling, which I still couldn't quite put my finger on.
Mm.
And I think maybe at that point, maybe I suspected it might be more serious because I had come out to my parents, although I couldn't come out as transgender because the word didn't exist. So
no, it didn't, did it?
I could only come out as being confused and I don't know what this is.
Yeah,
and I'd seen a psychoanalyst for about a year and a half, I think, and that didn't really go anywhere because I think the thrust of it was like to try and change me.
Normalize you.
Yeah.
That's how it was, wasn't it?
Yeah.
More or less in those days. You know, and even, sadly,
It still exists. There's still the sense that you can make it go away. Or if you understand it enough.
Yes, yes.
And I'd also started reading Arthur Janoff, you know, The Primal Scream.
I went through a phase where I read all of Janoff. Yeah. I thought he was fantastic.
Well, he was a genius, I think.
Yeah,
and of course, he was also John Lennon's therapist.
Yeah, he was.
So I got.
That
Plastic Ono Band.
And
that blew my mind completely.
And then
I started thinking, well, I really want to do this. Maybe this therapy, it's like the nuclear option. Because surely this must have some root, some primal root.
Definitely.
It doesn't actually, but at the time, so that was at the back of my mind. It's like, if I could just, talk about shoot for the moon. I could just have Arthur Janoff as my therapist, like John Lennon did, it'll all work out. Meanwhile, we're gigging. We lost the record deal. I can't remember exactly what order, but I got a job as a tape op in a studio in North London called Decibel Studios.
Yeah.
It's not there anymore.
No.
Because I wanted to make a bit of money and hourly rate and all that. Within about 3 months, I was engineering.
Oh, yes.
And then there was a few studios. Pathway was another one.
Mm.
It got popular around 76, 77. Because it was small and funky, and that's when we had T-Rex in.
I
met Mark Boland. He'd been my hero. He still was.
Yes, yeah.
He was a hero, and he was kind of pretty. He was beautiful. I mean,
yes,
very beautiful.
Yes, man. That's right.
I ended up recording and mixing "I Love to Boogie," which was, he hadn't had a hit for about 2 years, I think, which at the time was considered, you know, if you didn't have a hit every few weeks, So we did it in an afternoon.
Did you?
Yeah.
I think it's a great sound. And it was used, I don't know how long after it was recorded, it was used for as part of the soundtrack of Billy Elliot.
I'm quite proud of that mix.
Yeah, definitely. Can we play it? Let's play it, shall we?
Yeah, let's play it.
Yeah.
It was done at 7.5 IPS, interestingly.
Right, there you are, listeners.
More what meant.
Any of you are out there.
So we will play on Mark Boland's Revox. That's the reason.
I Love to Boogie, Mark Boland.
We love to boogie. Jitterbug boogie. Boland Billy boogie.
walking all the way home. The passion of the earth, blasted his mind. Now it needs sweet, ready for the moon bass grind. We love to boogie. We love to boogie on a Saturday night. I said we love to boogie. We love to boogie. High school boogie. Jitterbug boogie. We love to boogie on a Saturday night. With a tail feathers high, jitterbug left and smiled to the sky. With your black velvet cape and your stovepipe hat, bebop baby, the dance is where it at. I love to boogie. Yes, I love to boogie on a Saturday night. I said I love to boogie. I love to boogie. Jitterbug boogie. I love to boogie. I love to boogie on a Saturday night.
Well, that was Mark Boland, and a wonderful song, a wonderful mix that that Jen did on that. Yeah. So, yeah, that's quite something. So, and when was that? That was the
76. I think that was 76 or 77, I believe. Yeah. Yeah, so I was like 19.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was shortly after that, I did end up going to Los Angeles.
Right, yeah.
With my girlfriend at the time. And,
yeah, yeah.
And I did do primal therapy.
Oh, you did?
With Janoff. I mean, he wasn't my personal therapist.
No, but you know, in his institute or his...
Yeah, he was there in the group.
Yeah, wow.
And,
yes.
Which was an amazing experience, but it didn't stop me from being trans.
No, no. No, no, it didn't.
No, it did lots, but not, you know.
That's right, yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's when I sort of gave up on the idea of therapy kind of fixing me, as it were.
Yes, yeah.
And sort of came back and just threw myself into music again.
Mm.
And, you know, one thing led to another. And then in 83, a drummer that I'd done a session with, Justin Hildreth, he was working with Joe and I were trading. And I can't remember if he called me or he might have sent me a letter, because in those days it was like that.
Yeah, letters, yeah.
And it was Joe who was looking for a bass player. Oh. And, why don't you come along and, you know, I guess it was an audition. I mean, I just went along and played.
Yeah.
And I got a call and said, oh, Joe wants you to join the band. And
wow.
And what's more, we're doing a world tour. And I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah,
and that was an amazing experience. And I met lots of people.
Yes.
I mean, it was incredible. I mean, she's an amazing artist.
Yeah, she's
a
wonderful.
I learned a lot from her, just being on stage with her.
Yeah, yeah.
I must have done a couple of hundred gigs at least with Joe.
Yes.
And I would have carried on playing with her, but I just, you know, she loves to tour. And, you know, I can't keep up that.
No.
She's still at it, you know.
I think you might know one of my earlier guests on this show, Les.
Oh, Les, let's play with Joan.
Let's play with Joan and do the tour.
Yeah, we weren't in the band at the same time.
No,
Well,
that must have been an experience, yeah.
So on that tour, I met Phil Palmer.
He's
a great guitar player. Still a dear friend. We still work together.
Yes.
You know, and through Phil, I met other people. One thing leads to another. I ended up playing with Paul Brady.
Yeah.
Fantastic artist.
Yes.
And also joining the Penguin Cafe Orchestra.
Oh, yes. Yes.
I think in 84.
Mm.
Not that long after that, actually. So I was doing all these things sort of simultaneously.
Yes, yes.
And trying to juggle.
Yeah.
So joined the Penguin Cafe Orchestra, where I met my my partner now.
Of course, Annie. Yeah.
Annie.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So, you know, and we played together for 3 years before we became a couple.
Yes.
And we're still working together and we're still together. We're still a couple.
Yes.
So, you know, nearly 30 years together now.
Yes.
And then in 86, I had a call. This is relevant, actually, to how transition is. Because I was just like, well, I'll just, you know, I was just like a workaholic, really. I'll throw myself into work.
Yes.
I'll just ignore this.
That's right.
Gender incongruence, yeah, or whatever, yeah, it is, you know.
Yes.
But then in the mid-80s, then the whole Boy George phenomenon, yeah, had been happening.
Yes.
And George, of course, was a George, huge kind of cultural icon.
Yeah.
Certainly was on my radar, but I didn't,
yeah,
know him.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah,
I was in the west of Ireland in a, yeah, motel, and I got a phone call.
Yeah.
And it's a producer called Stuart Levine.
Yeah.
Who was a great producer, mm, you know, worked with B.B. King and Joe Cocker.
Yeah.
And he said, I'd done a session for him, and he said,
yeah,
I'm going to go to Montserrat with Boy George, and I'd like you to come play bass. I mean, you know, you can't make this sort of stuff up. And I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, well, so, yeah, you know, I was touring Paul and,
yes,
went back to London, got on a plane,
mm,
to Montserrat, and,
yeah,
made an album with George, which, yeah, is his first solo album.
Yeah.
And then the next thing, George said, do you want to come out on the road?
Mm.
And it was a bunch of session players, really, at that point.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember George just said, I'm sorry, you know, but I've got to say, you all look quite boring. You know, because he's used, yeah, to Culture Club.
And, of course, you know, yeah,
he wasn't toning it down.
No, I think
something in me kind of went, well, it's now or never, you know.
Yeah,
and George,
yeah,
said, well, you know, do you want to get your hair done or something? And I think he just thought a haircut. And I went and got these extensions.
Yeah,
and within weeks, I was,
yeah,
on stage with sort of hair, mm, extensions, mm, mini skirt,
yeah,
high heel boots.
Yeah.
It was like, wow, you know, I went from, I think it was quite alarming probably to some people.
Yes. Because, yeah,
they thought I was just this very kind of sober, sort of, yeah, hold your own kind,
yeah,
of,
yeah,
session musician.
Yeah.
But it was, yeah, it was, you know, thanks to George for that. Mm. It was a platform for me in a way to sort of start, yeah, begin to explore my, yeah, identity.
Of course.
Which I still didn't really understand.
No.
Didn't think of myself as transsexual at that point.
No.
But, you know, I knew that there was something different. Yeah. I knew it wasn't just pantomime.
No, that's right.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that was the thing.
Mm.
And then, yeah, I got to go with Annie sort of in 1990.
Yeah.
You know, so she knew me as sort of a guy that wore dresses.
Yeah.
Which she, you know, she said, well, that was sort of quite interesting in a way.
Yes,
you know?
Yeah.
And I thought of myself that way, in a sense.
Yeah.
But at a certain point, I began to just sort of, I think the aging process, again, it's like puberty.
Yes, yes.
For someone who's trans in the way that I am, it's a bit like when you go through puberty and your body's sort of going against you.
Yeah.
I was, you know, where are we? I was coming up to sort of my 30s.
Yes.
And aging in a kind of male way. And,
yeah.
And something,
yeah,
in me was going, no.
You, yeah, yeah.
And so that became more and more urgent. And sure. I was trying to stuff it down.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I've had all sorts of therapies, you can imagine.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
But at a certain point, I just realised it was just, I was looking at the, it's like looking the wrong way down a telescope.
Yes, yeah.
I was looking at it from, yeah, the wrong end.
That's right.
As a thing that needed to be, that needs to be fixed. And I thought, yeah, no, actually, I'm who,
yeah,
I am.
Yeah.
And I'm going to have to sort of figure out how to be this person in the world.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's when the possibility of transition really came onto the radar. But it still seemed, even then, it seemed very exotic and very left field.
Yeah.
It,
yeah,
wasn't a mainstream thing at all.
No.
Despite people like George, it was still dressing up. Really.
Yeah, that's right.
And in a way, I didn't want to have to dress up.
No.
That was just a way of trying to show the world,
yeah,
something. You know, really, I just wanted to be like, look at me today. I'm just wearing a pair of jeans. And,
yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm not, you know, it's fun. You know, it was fun for a while.
Yeah.
After a while,
yeah,
you go, my God, these shoes hurt. You know, you just, you don't want to have to do that.
No.
You just assert your identity, you know.
What was the significant thing next then that actually got you to, you know, really have, well,
to go through the whole
process? Go through the whole process.
Well, yeah, there was a lot of talking, I think, and Annie was like hugely supportive and, yes, and you know, interested and supportive, and I had a therapist as well, and once I realized I was looking at it the wrong way, then it was like, well what's a manageable practical way of, because it's not going to change, you know. I've done all these different, I've had primal therapy,
yeah,
I've thrown everything at this thing, you know. this is who I am. So I went to see a guy called Russell Reed. He was a doctor.
Yes.
And he was, I mean, now it's still not easy, but
no,
there are avenues now.
There are.
In those days, it was very difficult. And it was almost word of mouth. It's like, well, go and see Russell Reed.
Yeah.
And he very quickly sort of, you know, he took a full history and everything. Yes. And just went, well, you know, you're obviously transgender,
yeah.
You know, and
yes.
He said, you don't really have a choice about that, but you do have a choice about how what you can do about it. And he said, I can put you on hormones, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And he said, it's a very good, this is the health aspect. Yes.
Yeah.
It's a really good diagnostic tool because
that's right,
it's all reversible.
Yes. Yes.
And he said, you know, if you don't like it, you can stop.
Yeah,
you
know, exactly.
But if you do like it, then it probably means this could be a road for you to go down.
Yeah.
So he did that. It wasn't the first meeting, but I think the second.
Yeah.
And it really was a revelation.
It was
like, the analogy I'd make is like you sort of realise you've been running your car on the wrong fuel or something.
Yes.
I suddenly just felt.
Yes.
It's really hard to describe. I felt an ease that I'd never felt. Since I've been a very young child.
I mean, I can't identify.
Yeah.
However, I've got a slight empathy because about a year ago, I had hormone treatment.
Right.
For prostate cancer.
Right. Oh, well, there you go.
And I had injections and it was strong, you know.
Yeah.
I'm off them now and things are only just like returning to how I was.
Yeah.
But how I can empathise is the... Yeah, I can imagine because it's very strong. Powerful.
It's a powerful stuff.
I mean, in my case, it was a reverse of yours. My testosterone stopped.
And, right.
You know, my breasts increased. And
right.
Really, there is a little bit of
empathy. Yeah. And I imagine that, you know, that wasn't a particularly welcome thing for you.
No. But I was pre-warned.
Well,
but
I remember Russell saying that. He said, you know, if you're not transgender, you won't like this.
No. he was right.
But it's like something in me just relaxed. And I've been having this testosterone thing.
That's right.
You know, and I've been trying to make it work for me. And it just doesn't work.
No.
You know, and it's like my brain. I mean, I'm very sceptical about the whole male female brain thing because I don't. I think we're all a bit of everything.
I know.
But there was, I'm sure there was something in my brain that was just going, oh, thank God for that.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah,
you know,
but I can. It just glimpsing into this. I didn't welcome the physical changes, but I must admit, I welcome the emotional and psychological thought of, you know, my testosterone as it when it was blocked.
Yeah,
there was a kind of peace of mind.
Yes,
there really was.
Yeah,
because I realized how much we function, you know, on this and.
Well, sometimes. It's designed to, I mean, all these hormones, they're designed to do a certain job. Aren't
they,
in a way?
Yeah.
You know, it's like go out and kill an animal, and, you know, put it on the fire or whatever.
Not to be too graphic, but who was that guy? He was a great blues singer, a white blues singer. He was a real George trumpet player, big, larger than life character.
George Melly. Yeah, yeah.
He said, you know, I never forget in his autobiography, he said, you know, when his libido went, he said it was like a caged tiger. he was released, you know, freedom.
But I met George Melly once. Now, so, he kissed me.
Ah.
Uninvited. I mean, it wasn't abusive. But but, you know, he was obviously on form that day.
Yeah, it must have been a wonderful experience for you to actually... feel
it was a relief. It was relief, also scary because it was like, oh dear, you know, there's an element of oh dear,
and
through all of this there was fear because it was like, well, how is this going to be? But you know, I told my family.
Yeah.
My parents obviously weren't totally surprised because they'd known that
something's
been going for years. My mum was especially relieved. It's like, well, as long as you're happy, you know.
That's lovely.
As long as you're happy and safe,
of course. Yeah.
And you know, and eventually, I mean, went through. You know, the whole process. Which is sort of terrifying, but also an amazing.
Yeah.
If you just look at it as an experience, it's life in general, isn't it?
Yeah, that's
just
right.
Looking at it as an experience.
Exactly, yeah.
And I came to see it that way. It's like, wow.
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't necessarily ask for this.
No.
Or maybe I did. Some people say you do.
Well, yeah.
You know, before you were born. But
I know. But...
since I don't have much choice and it's happening,
yeah,
I might as well just sort of enjoy the ride.
And yeah, exactly.
Actually, a life in two genders. That's
Well, that's quite something.
That's the subtitle of a book actually by a woman called Jennifer Finney Boylan.
Ah,
who's a great author. You know, yeah. She's written some great stuff.
Yeah.
I think it's called She's Not There, A Life in Two Genders.
Wow. Yeah.
What a great privilege to actually see these things.
Yeah, that's right.
And I don't know. And now I sometimes think, well, maybe I've ended up somewhere. I think we all degender to some extent as we get older.
Yeah, I think we do.
And I might be sort of veering back towards the middle again.
Yeah.
Who knows? I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
But it's all that process of just... It's like, I see us as like, we're like snakes, aren't we? Shedding our skin.
We are. That's a good analogy. Yeah. You wonderful. Know. Yeah, we are. Shedding another skin and then moving into another. And
I just needed to shed my male skin
for
whatever reason.
Yeah.
This time around, you know. Maybe I'll come back as, who knows, a snake.
Maybe Phoebe.
A cat, yeah. Yeah,
she has a lovely cat called Phoebe.
Yeah, Phoebe's been watching.
She's been joining us in the interview.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, and that was, when was that, the actual procedure or process of transitioning?
Officially 2000, so 19 years ago.
All right, so you would, I suppose, summarise, you know, the last 20 years, you've had peace of mind and...
Life still happens.
Life still happens.
You know, you've still got all the sort of, you know, relationship issues, codependency.
Of course.
Shopping, you know, food.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. But I think it is so fundamental.
Yeah.
You know, if to anyone that's listening that really thinks this might be me, I think it's worth, you know, it's definitely worth the... The slog of getting through it, because it's, you know, it can feel like God, you know, do I have to go through this?
And also Jen I was just mildly researching a little bit, and suicide rates for, you know, young people with transgender issues are much higher.
They are
nearly 20% higher than the norm, you know, so there's lots of young people out there.
It's still an issue,
and a big issue,
and especially my generation. I know there's lots that didn't make it because people you know, I was lucky, I had relatively tolerant middle-class parents and good friends, and I was in the music industry, which has always been a sort of oasis, isn't it?
Very much so, yeah.
So, you know, people were sort of going, yeah, well, you know, as long as you're happy.
That's it. And also, some years ago, you and Annie bought a little place up in Woodstock.
Yeah.
That's an oasis. Because on Facebook, you know, you post a lot of what's going on up there. I've been to Woodstock. It's a lovely part of the world, and you do a lot of music up there.
Yeah, so, yeah. 2014, we bought a little house there.
Yeah.
Super cheap. And it's become a real platform for, funny enough, for me to do some more of my own music, my own songs.
Yeah.
I made an album there called Dreamland with people there. And
yes.
Some great people. David Thorne, well known since the 80s.
Yes.
Amazing guitar player. Jerry Marotta.
Yes.
And, of course, Annie's on it as well.
Yeah.
And lots of other great people.
Yeah.
Guest appearances from Paul Brady.
Oh, he's and, Paul. Oh, I saw you.
And the Penguin Cafe Orchestra people are on there.
Yeah.
So it was almost like bringing all those things.
Yeah.
Trying to bring those threads together and just... And so, well, if I only ever make one solo album, I mean, I hope to make another one.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, at least this will sort of... It's almost like a little record of parts of the journey, I think, you know.
Well, I think, you know, what better thing should we go out on, piece of music, than a track from your album, from Dreamland. And this is called The Letting Go, isn't it? Which we were talking about before. A lot of life is letting go, isn't it?
And I should say the chords for this song were written by an old and dear friend of mine. From teenage years, a guy called Mick Gaiman.
Right.
Who was with the Ruts and still plays sometimes with the Blockheads and he's a harmonica player. But he wrote these chords. I put the words to the chords.
Right, okay.
And we just came up with this song. It's just about, well, you know, it's all imagery from life and it's all about letting go. You know.
So listeners, you know, check out Jennifer's album. Dreamland, it's a wonderful album, and Jennifer, it's just been a lovely experience to just listen to you and learn a bit more about your life and times. So thank you for being my guest.
Oh, thanks, Jim. It's been such a pleasure, honestly. It's so nice to see you. And, you know, I hope we get to do it again. We don't have to have a tape recorder.
Thanks, Jen. Here's the letting go from Dreamland. Thank you for listening, everyone, and join me next time. Here's the number of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a fellowship for anyone who has a drinking problem. The number is 0800 917 7650. That's 0800 917 7650. The number of Narcotics Anonymous, this is a fellowship for anyone who has a drug problem. That's from 10 a.m. till midnight. The number is 0300 999 1212. 0300 999 1212. And finally, Al-Anon, which is a fellowship to support family and friends of the alcoholic. It's from 10 a.m. till 10 p.m. The number is 0207 403 0888. That's 0207 403 0888.